As our guest today, we have Bertie Green. Now, Bertie didn't want me to read from his profile, but I'm going to read some anyway because I think it was pretty cool. Well, first of all, he's a chief technologist and a CISO advisor. He is also an ASU graduate, just like me, as he is continuously learning. And when you look at the role of a chief information security officer, that is one of the most important things, especially in this changing environment. Bertie, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you. No, I've been really looking forward to this. I love the episodes I listened to before coming on, and I've known Eric for a bit. I'm a big fan of his. So any friend of his is a friend of mine.
Well, let's just dive into this. We talked about continuous learning and self-learning. What are some of the most important things that you have found in the field of technology?
Great question. What I've learned is how to maximize the value of what you learn. That if you do learn something for a singular purpose, yes, it can be used for that direct purpose, but how else can it be reapplied? And basically maximizing that use. One of the mentees I had, we used to say, is there a doctor in the house? We're going to say, is there a hacker in the house, right? It's that kind of a skill set where we need to have people like that that can translate and be on hand.
There's a guy on YouTube, he's always hacking into these companies that are trying to rip off people. When you look at that kind of hack, you have to understand where your opponent is coming in from. Mm. How have you helped companies deal with some of those hacks by thinking like a hacker?
I consider myself to be technically capable. If people say, are you technical? The answer is technically capable. That doesn't mean I know everything about every technology. Mm-hmm. But your question to me seems more relevant to how is that information applied? So understanding the psychology of the end users, what are people going to click? How are people going to feel? And so hackers are oftentimes preying on the emotion of things, not on the big iron in the ports. And so if you can empathize, I know I'm talking about malicious actors that are scum, but also if they can empathize with how the end user will react, that's really what is happening. And so you look at things like Freakonomics, that book that combined finance and psychology, very much the same way security works. It's multidisciplinary because it's not just one thing. It's a combination of things.
Man, I'm geeking out here. I never even heard about that preying on the emotion side of it, because this is so linear, not linear in thinking, but technical, typically. And you take that emotion out of it. And of course, when I'm talking with an engineer, and I'm a kind of an emotional kind of guy, I found that the ones I connect with most are those people that have that ability to tie in those emotions. And I never even thought about that from an ill-intended individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is awesome. I'm glad that Bertie he has the ability to really eloquently tell how this works, because this is how we're different as humans than just machines, is we also do have a lot of emotions, and we make decisions based on those, whether they're good or bad. And we make decisions on multiple things, multiple inputs, such as technical decisions combined with emotional decisions and experiences. When I interview people for departments, I have a lot of questions like this, and it's exactly what Bertie said. Like, okay, tell me about an experience when, and then I'll have it in a technical subject. The rationale behind asking that question is seeing how they would attack a problem, how they would logically do that. But also you can understand some of the emotion that they go through, because maybe they've had an experience like a breach, and they've been able to go through it. And other business individuals have seen that. And obviously, it's very stressful when those type of things occur. And so how do they handle that? How do they react? I think what Bertie is really bringing forward is that when we're looking at security or IT or technology, we really have to understand the human factor of emotions that go into it. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna stop talking. I want to hear more about.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I did cut you off right before I asked that question to Eric, so I apologize. But what were you going to go delve into there, Bertie?
Oh, I think just the basics of emotions often trump logic. I mean, there was a hidden brain on NPR about this, about political posts and things like that on social media. And I won't go into the political side of it, but they did do analysis on the way the neurons fire and people go into defense mode and recovery mode. So if you can trigger these emotions, you are getting people to deactivate logic. Almost. And so that's when you see UPS and FedEx space fishes coming in around the holidays, they know damn well that you are really hoping that package gets there on time and you'll click without thinking. So it's the emotion of the thing that they're preying on.
this is geeking me out just from my background is in organization psychology. And I remember I would talk to, with the technical audience. I would talk with the sales forces and they were so different. But what's funny is, as you can tell, I'm very emotional. I love to connect with people from emotional side of it. And it's funny because I'll connect. And then if stuff isn't going wrong, my next emotion is anger and it goes, why, what's going on? And then I become incredibly logical. It's weird. It's a weird cycle. But then on the flip side of that, my experience has been with incredibly logical thinkers is logic. And then if someone's not getting it, there's something goes, why aren't you getting this? And so it's more logic. And then they become emotional, like, it's going on here. It was funny to see that these different patterns of behavior. I found that the people that got it from a leadership perspective, but also in connecting with external customer, were the ones that tied that cross-section together.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like the best hackers probably get that. They understand that.
Eric, please, CISO first.
So hackers, that's what they play on. They, with phishing, right? And Bertie explained it very well. There'll be a really well-crafted logo. It looks official. Hopefully you're already logged in the browser where you're trying to hijack the credentials. Most of it is emotion-based. A really good course that I've seen some other people take, or a certification actually, offensive security certification, is probably one of the best courses that I've seen. It discusses a lot of this. And so you're really thinking in terms of a hacker. That's how they play on people. They play on people that they're busy. So they might send you a lot of push notifications to authenticate. I saw an attack where somebody was sending Okta push notifications. They were trying to use user fatigue, like, oh, I keep getting these things. I'm just going to push accept. They were actually phishing tests to see if somebody would fall for it. And so you would even get senior people falling for this and clicking it because they would get so many of these. And so really, a lot of these things are emotion-based, whether people are in a hurry, whether, like you said, oh, I'm going to expect something really cool for Christmas. I want to see this thing arise, so I'm going to click on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where machines and humans differ, because humans have that. It's like Pavlov's dog. It's like, oh, I'm going to get a treat. I hear a ding. Really, almost like Maurice said, you have to kind of take that away from your thinking for a while and just go straight logical for a bit. But then also understanding we are humans and we work with other humans. And also looking at things like the sales side, that is emotional. When somebody has a good sales presentation, they're like, wow, this is exactly the capability I need. I'm going to sign on the dotted line. It's going to solve all my problems, whether it does or not. Those things are logical as well. So you're working with other business units that understand human logic and they get really good at it. That's why you see senior salespeople, you know, they're really good at selling. They could sell you anything. I think it's good to understand all the other people that you work with really get this type of human emotional intelligence level, but then also layering with that technology and how hackers think, and they're playing on that.
I have another question, because we're talking about hackers and they're feeding off the emotions of potential victims. How do you keep the organization that you're in from losing their mind from the emotional side of it? How do you bring that down?
Everything from this point on is make it sound easy, but it's absolutely not. Everything from here is extremely difficult, but contextualizing the business and its risk. A lot of people look for the template of what should I be buying. It's really dependent upon how your business operates, who are your stakeholders, who are the employees who have access to information, what are they doing with that information. Let's use an example of a mortgage business. And I run into this one a lot. If you're a mortgage business, you have all of your application paperwork publicly available, and you have sales reps sitting to receive said Excel docs or PDFs. Those folks are dying to make cash. And so they get sent these documents laced with malware. That's an obvious process issue. There's other ways to do this, and it's more complicated. Sure, you might have to create lockdown pages or something. But if you're publicly displaying those docs, people can use OSINT to find docs that are publicly available very quickly. A good Google dork will have that very quickly.
That actually scares the crud out of me, because there's so much information that I put out there and I didn't even realize.
Balance.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah. Do you want to be the easy button to work with, but you also want to be, you know, protected? So that is the balance beam. And that's the art of being a good CISO or security leader, whatever the title is, understanding the business and being able to explain the risk. And I feel like in past years, I've seen most CISOs be hyperbolic or almost a caricature of risk aversion, that they are the no, no, no people. And that means the business people are the yes, yes, yes people. Then we'll land in the middle. But that's not real anymore. CISOs that I believe are successful and serving their organizations the most are like Eric. They speak business. They speak cyber. They speak the entire suite because you are a translator in that role.
Okay, Eric, you know I'm going to throw that over to you next.
Well, thank you for that, Bertie. Thank you for that plug. So this is real. Security has always been the department of no, because as Bertie explained, you have convenience, like being able to do something quickly. And then you have security that's trying to put all the locks on everything. And so if security can make wins with departments, that's like, let's say you're first engaging with a business unit and they want to do something, it's always good to build that bridge with them and show them how they can do something properly and also build it better for them to use, but then build it secure and show them that you build it secure. Everybody feels good about that. You want to protect the customer data, company data, intellectual property, third-party data, regulated data, and so forth. So you want to have that under your control and protect it. But also when you can show those wins to the business, like, yeah, we can sell more or whatever it is, reach more customers, we can do this better. And if you can help them do that, it's a win. And so I think that that's the approach, because then people will come to you. They won't hide things. They won't say, hey, guess what? We were using AI this whole time and we were doing all this stuff and putting our own data in it and throwing it to somewhere and we had no control of the data. And that's the key point, is really having control of your data, whether it's publicly accessible and understanding what type of data you're putting out there and it meets requirements to be publicly accessible or internally controlled. Yeah, Bertie's right. You have to be able to speak in terms of the business or you're probably going to be shown the door pretty soon.
Yeah.
If you're just saying no to everything.
Business as an enabler, or security as an enabler, Eric, that is such a big thing, that if you have security controls, that should be pitched. That should be part of your sales pitch as a differentiator, how committed your organization is. I don't see a lot of that stuff often, but if you are going to, back to maximizing value from a knowledge or an investment, that's part of it. You're right. I am seeing people like you, Eric, Sean Marion, former McDonald's. Some of you guys are really good at the business side, my perspective.
It really does help in sales conversations, because one of the, well, I don't want to say last parts, but one of the parts of sales negotiations, and I've seen this before, especially in Europe, CISO to CISO conversations, asking these things with really large, huge companies, manufacturing companies, banks, banking infrastructure, pharmaceutical, all of these very large companies. And so they have a lot of money on the line, a lot of reputation on the line. And so you'll have a CISO to CISO conversation. And when you can show them the assurance of your security controls and also third-party controls, if they're using a cloud system, like a multi-tenant system, and you show them, okay, not only do we pass specifications, audits, requirements, different things like this, certifications, accreditations, but also here's the things that we do in above that to surpass these controls, because we feel this is important for you to use our system as a third party, because we know your regulations and you'll be able to explain this to your own auditors and your own customers that what you're using is secure. And so when you're able to do that and do that with a CISO or head of security or directors of security or whoever it is, a lot of times these are also legal conversations that you have with other companies' legal departments, you're able to show that it does make the difference between being able to sell and a competitor being able to sell to that same company.
What you're talking about, it, I think, is something I learned through my sales experience, which was early on, if you throw a quote to a customer and say, let me know when you're going to buy, you're asking that customer to take that quote, justify it, and get it approved. You've given them a little bit of the tools, but giving them a proposal that makes sense, the ROI, all the risk involved, at that point, all they have to do is forward. Help them deliver that message so it doesn't get lost. I feel like that's a lot of what CISOs do today internally.
I return back to what we were talking about at the beginning, and that is the importance of self-learning and continuous education. I was looking at some of the stats, and this came by more by way of people that we've interviewed. And that is, the average life of a CISO in an organization is typically not that long.
Like, so, a running back.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a couple different things. The environment makes it so it's an evolving role. So that being said, what can a CISO or someone in a like role do to stay relevant? Also, what are some of the dangers that an organization faces with this ever-revolving door?
I got arguments. I have points on both sides of that.
Excellent.
So having a CISO, CIO, any technical person, actually, let's just say any executive. A lot of executives come in with a change plan or something. If somebody's being replaced or coming in, that's because the old thing wasn't working, according to chairman of the board or whatever. So if somebody comes in, they have a 2 or 3 year plan that they pitched. Usually that's kind of, they did their stint, you know, I did my thing and then I move on. I don't know if that's a bad thing or not, because is it good that we have someone coming in with fresh eyes every couple of years? Maybe. Now here's the downside, is some of the hard work takes more than 2 or 3 years. Transformational projects take more than 2 or 3 years. It's like the Marvel movies, right? They have different directors, so none of it flows together, right? So if you're going to have a big transformational project, you kind of have to have one overseer. So I'm on both sides on whether that revolving door, as you called it, is a good or a bad thing for the business. I think it would be contextual to the org.
Any thoughts on that? Think.
Yeah, I got a lot of thoughts. oh boy, where do we start? Well, one of the reasons that you're seeing that too, there's a couple reasons, but last year there are a lot of requirements, regulations, there's SEC rules, of course, reporting on materiality, but also further than that, the liability down to a personal level to CISOs. And we've seen some cases in the news where it hasn't gone so great for CISOs. And so a lot of people are like, okay, wow, I would rather be maybe a data officer or something like that, not even be a CISO. But really, if you've got your ducks in a row, you shouldn't worry about that. If you're addressing those things, I know a lot of CISO personnel have put ways to address that, working with legal departments, making sure they have things done right at the beginning. And maybe that's why some people left. Maybe things weren't going so good in their organization. They didn't feel they wanted to keep the risk of staying there. And so there's those different types of aspects of why that is the case. Then also, there could be other reasons where maybe the CISO and the other C-level suite or leader personnel really didn't jive together. They had different motivations or different plans, and they didn't really jive. But one way that this can be successful, I know this in the international fintech I was in, was the CEO gave the CISO position I was in a lot of visibility and a lot of, I guess, speaking to the organization with town halls quarterly, but also visibility to speak to customers, whether it was at events or different large gatherings with customers, and being able to then hear what the CISO says and understand how it is an important part of their business. Because people want to use capabilities that are secure. That's big check mark. When they're going to purchase something and use it, they want to understand that that's working. But like Bertie said, when you get into a role and you've only been there a year, you kind of observe what's going on and you keep doing the things that are working good. And then you want to change the things that need improve based on your experience. So you have a plan for that. And it takes a while to execute that plan. And a lot of times you don't really see the full extent until you've been there like a year. And then once you are able to make bigger plans, that takes a good 3 years. Another part of this too is organizations change. They merge, acquire, they bring on different business units, and they have different ideas and they want to bring in some of their own people. And so that could be a reason that there's a change in CISO roles. And then there's many variables to this, but the companies that are doing this good or doing it correctly, in my mind, in my experience, in my point of view, opinion, is the ones that will listen to the CISO and they don't play Where's Waldo and let's hide them under this organization and not hear from them. They're able to engage with them and say, this is what we want to do as a business. How do we do it right? And then just have that dialogue, have that communication. Don't be afraid of the CISO position because it's a lot of technical mumbo jumbo and you don't understand what it is. Because a good CISO should be able to translate that into business terms. And so the more that you just meet and have these conversations, the better it is, and say, here's our goals. Here's our business goals. Here's what we want to do. How do we align security goals with this? And then bring it through the whole organization down to all personnel, because you have different personnel that have different duties and you have overlaps with them as well. And so that's how you build it. So like in a workday system, you have people's goals and all of that stuff, but aligns with the business unit. And then you're able to fulfill those. You're able to show those and say, yes, we're executing on this good, or here's something that needs improvement. We might need more people, more training. I think that once it really takes, I would say a year, year and a half before you're really hitting that second stride and you're able to do some big things. And it's kind of also like Birdie said earlier, you can take something that you've learned and apply it in to something else, and you might apply it differently. We talked about this on different podcasts where we've taken federal type of requirements, plug them into different industry requirements like financial or whatever it might be, but you're able to learn something that has a big impact and you're able to change that. And I think with this continued learning that Birdie's talking about, you're able to get those building blocks and then you're able to think about it as a human and say, wow, this is changing. Look at AI. Here's the changing way people are doing business. Now I've learned this thing. Here's where I can apply it, but also I can continue learning. I don't want to grow moss and just like, oh, I learned this stuff 10 years ago. Well, that doesn't work in our society nowadays with technology. That just sheerly doesn't work. And so you have to continually learn. You have to keep technically adept to things and be able to understand technical things, but then also understand the changing business environments as well and understand financial environments, different, almost like political environments. Like, are people wanting to spend money? Do they want to spend money in technologies? Do they want to buy your product? Are companies having like headwinds? Are they saying, look, our spending plan is going to be next year. This year, we're just going to cut costs. So understanding all of those environments, it's very good to continually learn all of those things. And that's a lot of things for a person to do. But really, it's like going out and getting news feeds every day. And this is what CISOs do. They look at Wall Street Journal in the morning, kind of get an indication of, this is what people are doing. And then they can talk to their other business people. They can talk to their technical teams. They can understand also things like indications of compromise or whatever telemetry you're getting into your security operations center. And you can kind of put patterns into your head and do more research. I know I'm just rambling, but these are kind of things that CISOs and heads of security departments, directors of security operations center, these are things they do. They're just very aware of things. They're continually learning. They've got their experiences that they've had before. They make the best decisions they can. And they also combine that with acceleration with things like AI and machine learning.
Absolutely. And what Eric said, there was some nuance to it that I think a lot of people don't give enough credit to, which is the CISO is often the one creating the common lexicon for the business to communicate. That we can basically say what risk is, but unless we agree how to define the risk and what the terms are and what the stakes are, then we're not speaking the same language from then on. So that's why a lot of people use risk assessments and things like that to create a common lexicon to speak. But whatever it is for your organization, having that common lexicon and knowing that something Eric said also I'm pulling from, if you can't explain it simple enough, you don't understand it well enough. And that's something I think we get in security, but tech in general is like, well, somebody can't understand something, figure out a different way to say it. It's not on them. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some people who don't want to understand no matter how simple you make it. Yeah. Don't cater to them endlessly, but do put it in true effort to make it understood by all. Because what we do is affects everybody. Yep. So it has to make sense to everybody at different degrees.
And you did bring up a common lexicon and such, and I'm going to utilize that as a segue in another piece. You have a media series called Standout in 90 Seconds. And I know you do some producing on that. It brings a lot of cybersecurity people together. What are some of the commonalities that you see in interviewing everyone over there? But also, what is it that you think needs some work so that we could come together?
Wow, great question. So Ashwin Krishnan started the Standout in 90 Seconds show about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Uh-huh. And he and I met just by happenstance that I came across his show on my feed. Two of my friends, one of which is the one who introduced me to Eric, coincidentally, were looking for roles at the time. So I said, hey, Ash, check out a few of my friends. They would be great guests kind of thing. And so we kind of buddied up from that point, and I have a laundry list of people I think are interesting to me. So I shared them with Ashwin and they were on the show. I do think a common thread and one that I noticed a lot of them talk about their significant other. Mm-hmm. And there's something grounding about that, like a respect for home and family that I've noticed in a lot of those interviews. A lot of the questions about what's your biggest regret? A lot of people's answer is, I don't have any regrets, which was my answer too, because I am who I am because of the good, bad, and ugly. But then they share, I just wish I could connect with the world simpler or something. So there's a lot of that humility and a lot of real authenticity that comes through. And these are folks that don't often get that forum. If you're a security leader, you're only really involved at budget season with executives and when an accident or a cyber risk happens. So I just think it's a really cool opportunity to see the beauty in what these people's motivations truly are and why they're leading. And one of the folks that spoke on the show, I'll share this, was Sean Marion from McDonald's. I've already mentioned him once. He ended up having two episodes because it was so good. They kept running. So they just kept going and then they made it two episodes. But I got pinged by somebody from their DEI group right after. And they said, I didn't know our CISO was so freaking cool. And I was took the opportunity to say, yeah, you have no idea how lucky you are. Sean is the man, you know, but I love that. Like, and Eric mentioned this too, like showcase the CISO. A lot of times the CISO is reporting into the CIO who goes to the board meeting, who knows what the CIO is saying, you know, probably a doctored version of what the CISO said. And there's potentially reason for that. But I do think elevating the CISO to the point where they are a peer with CIOs, I think that is an important one. Who they report to, I'm kind of wishy-washy on, but I do think the CIO should not have cyber as part of their budget if available. I don't like that.
Again, this could go on and on. And you, speaking of a part two, I think we might have to go a part two just given the time here. This is incredibly interesting. And I see thoughts percolating in Eric's mind right now too. So I believe that this begets a part two. Would you be agreeable to that?
I'll be agreeable and I'll even leave a cliffhanger of the story I was going to tell then. And we'll start episode two with that, yes. That my first real, it was self-learning, but also I'll call it apprenticeship in that, you know, there was somebody when I was 11 years old, I had a neighbor who was older than me. And that's how I learned about hacking. That's how I learned about what a bulletin board system was. And technically when I got my first job was a file administrator for a BBS so I could play Doom 2. You know, so we'll talk a little bit about that, but that was completely propelled by me, yes, but I had somebody that I was apprenticing for in the end. That's how I look at it in hindsight. He didn't call me that. He showed me Beavis and Butthead and all the things I shouldn't have seen at 11, but he really propelled me, I think, in my technical passion.
I heard BBS out of that and I was like, yes, bulletin board system, like dial up. Oh, wow. That brings back memories. I can't wait to hear this one.
My parents are English, and when I asked them for money for that BBS, my mom said, "What's a BBS? Bloody bull!" You know, so, yeah.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks for having me on, gentlemen. Really appreciate it.